Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, each and every week, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, talking to you from the Kingdom of Bahrain. But we have a very, very special guest joining us today, all the way from the northeast of the United States of America. It's Harvard professor Robin Bernstein. Professor Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time. How the devil are you?
I'm fine. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
The pleasure is all ours. Please give us a little hors d'oeuvre, if you will. What will you be speaking about today? I know it's your new book, but for the benefit of the listeners who may not be familiar with it, what is the new book? And in a nutshell, what is it all about?
The book is called Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. This is a book about the origins of prison for profit in the United States. You know, we have this idea that a prison should sort of naturally be an economic entity. Think about if you wanted to build a prison in a town that didn't have a prison, and you wanted to convince the people in this town that this was a great idea for them to have a prison. Would you argue that the reason they should have a prison in their town is because prisons deliver justice, and our town is all about justice, and by building a prison, we will have more justice in our town? Or would you argue that prisons are really great because they help people become better, and we want our town to be a place where people become better people, and therefore we want to have a prison because that's going to help our people, help people in our town become better people? Or would you argue we should have a prison in our town because it'll bring jobs and it will help our local economy? Well, obviously, it's the last one. That's the argument that would actually work. And when you think about it, that's a really strange idea. Why should benefit economically from a prison? It's a very strange idea. And my book shows where that idea came from. And where it came from specifically was New York in the United States. And it was in the early 1800s, long before the Civil War. So this is the story I'm telling, and I tell it through one individual, and he was a teenager. His name was William Freeman. When he was 15 years old, he was accused of a horse theft, which he swore he did not commit. He was sentenced. It didn't matter that there was no evidence, no hard evidence against him. He was sentenced to 5 years hard labor in the Auburn State Prison, which was the original prison that invented this idea that a prison should exist centrally for the purpose of benefiting a local economy. And he resisted. He fought back. He was Black, and he was also Native American. He was incensed at being forced to labor for no wages at all. And he fought back. And my book tells his story.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Bernstein. I'm just thinking some of my history students in my classes won't be too surprised about the idea of prison for profit or a penal system predicated on the underlying raison d'etre of money, because I guess Australia in 1788, when the British take that, it's been in many ways ersatz America. Once they've lost America, they can't transport criminals there anymore. And one of the early governors, Lachlan Macquarie, used prison labour to help build up early British colonial Australia. So I guess maybe some of our British listeners on Australian perhaps won't be too surprised about that. Could you give us the context that William Freeman was living in? I guess independent America's roughly about 50 years old by that point. What would it have been like living in the part of America where he was? I know it's difficult and you don't want to oversimplify, but just to give us an hors d'oeuvre and a flavor.
Sure, I can do that. So William Freeman grew up in a thriving Black neighborhood in the town called Auburn. So Auburn is in central New York State, and it's by a lake and a river. And there was a small but strong Black community in Auburn. They lived in a neighborhood called New Guinea. They also called it the Settlement. And it was a good place to live. The New York State was in the process of abolishing slavery. So the northern states in the United States, most of them enacted what was called gradual emancipation, which meant that emancipation was rolled out over a number of years and sometimes over a number of generations. It was very slow. In New York State, what that looked like was a number of acts that did not free anybody who was enslaved, but did free their children, freed future children. So William Freeman was born in 1824, and he was born free. His father had been enslaved, but his father had become free. His mother, who was both Black and Native American, had always been free. So in the 1820s and 30s, when Freeman was a kid, the neighborhood of New Guinea was becoming more and more free, and there were more children being born who had never been enslaved. Auburn was also a place for the Underground Railroad. So a lot of people who were freeing themselves from Southern slavery were coming north, and they were coming through Auburn, and more of them were settling there. So the Black population of Auburn was growing. It was growing in part because there were self-freed people who were moving there. And also it was just growing naturally because it had an economy that was benefiting from the Auburn State Prison. And as the Auburn State Prison grew, and it was in fact benefiting the economy, although at a tremendous cost, it was also ironically economically benefiting many of the Black people in the town because they were part of the same economy as everybody else. So Freeman grew up in this community. He was also very special because he was part of Auburn's most prominent Black family. His grandparents, who had been named Harry and Kate, they had actually been enslaved, and they had been among the very first non-Native American people to come to the land that would become Auburn. The land that would become Auburn was originally, of course, Native American land, and that land was stolen and largely vandalized, specifically burned. The land was burned deliberately. On something called Sullivan's Campaign, which was a military venture ordered by General George Washington, the first president of the United States. So General George Washington ordered troops to come into New York State and destroy Native American communities and destroy their agriculture and build and burn their crops. So that is what they did. And then after that, the land was seized. And white people came into the land. They seized the land. They took ownership of the land. And some of them were also enslavers. So one of those people was John Hardenberg, a man named John Hardenberg, who enslaved Harry and Kate. So he came to Auburn in 1793 and forced Harry and Kate to start building buildings, and in particular to build a mill. And Harry and Kate eventually became free, and they were William Freeman's grandparents. So they were remember so Harry and Kate were loved, and they were known as the founders of Auburn's Black community. So William Freeman was part of this family. Everybody in he was well known in town. He was well liked in town. So he grew up in very favorable circumstances in a lot of ways. He also grew up in some difficult circumstances. He lost his father at an early age. His father passed away, and his mother had difficulty raising him as a single mother on a low wage income. And William Freeman was forced to work at a very early age, which he did not like. He wanted to be a kid, and that was not in not that was not an option for him economically. So he was forced to work at an early age, and he struggled with that.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Bernstein. So your work explores the intersection of race, capitalism, and incarceration. Could you elaborate a little on how understanding these intersections is perhaps crucial or fundamental or pivotal for comprehending the broader implications of the Freeman case?
Yeah, thank you. Right now, today, we kind of accept the entanglement of capitalism and carcerality. It seems natural to us. It seems obvious, like the idea that prisons should provide jobs, the idea that prisons should be good for an economy. But that is such a strange idea when you think about it. Why should it be that way? So one of the things that I'm hoping that this book will show is how there's nothing natural about that connection. There's nothing inevitable about that connection. There was a time when that idea was shocking and completely surprising and a complete innovation. And it was only 200 years ago. 200 years might sound like a long time, but in terms of human history, it's a really short time. There was a time when there was not that when that connection simply was not common sense. And so what I'm trying to do is bring us back to a moment of conception, a moment when people were coming up with this idea in the United States context. And by showing it, by showing how this, there's nothing true about this idea. This idea was conceived by individuals, and it was conceived by people who wanted to benefit their own businesses. It was conceived in the United States by entrepreneurs who basically wanted to improve their economic standing in life. And that's why they came up with this. So my hope is that by showing it and telling the story in a very vivid way through one person's life, my hope is that people will really note, will really see that there's nothing inevitable, first of all, about the connections between capitalism and incarceration. There's also nothing inevitable about prisons themselves. One of the strange things about the Auburn State Prison is that from the moment it was not even fully built, from the moment it began to be built, it seemed permanent, inevitable, unassailable. It just seemed like it was going to be a permanent fact of life and nothing could be done about it. And that's how a lot of us feel about prisons today, that, maybe prisons aren't a really great thing, but there's no possibility of having something else. There's no possibility of not having prisons. And what I want to show is that people actually believed that over 200 years ago. And they believed it when, in fact, prisons themselves in the United States had barely begun to exist. When the Auburn State Prison was only a year or two old, or when it wasn't even fully built, people already thought it was inevitable. And it wasn't inevitable. It wasn't inevitable then, and it isn't inevitable now.
In terms of the genesis of the prison system, then, Professor Bernstein, was it a sort of hangover from the colonial era? Was it something inherited from the British sort of architecture of control and establishment and colonialism, I guess, sort of starting with Jamestown in 1607? Or had it been modified and taken on its own, like, sort of American-esque trajectory by then? So, basically, in short, how much of this was just a sort of British colonial hangover, or had it evolved any since that time?
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, there's a relationship to the colonial prison and jail system. Of course, there is. For me, what I'm doing is emphasizing difference over similarity. When you have any kind of historical change, there's going to be both continuity and there's going to be change. And the question is, what are you emphasizing and why? For me, I'm emphasizing the difference. I'm emphasizing the change. So for Auburn, what is really important is the fact that this was a new concept in why a prison should exist, what its primary goal should be. Prior to Auburn, prisons existed in the United States, mainly either to punish people or to control people, that is to say, to simply get them off the streets, or they existed to reform people. To help people become people who did not commit criminal acts. And these were some of the options. And those options, of course, were inherited from colonialism. But Auburn was coming up with a really new idea in the United States context. And that was the idea that All of those other things, punishing people, controlling people, redeeming people, those were all secondary. The primary, the most important thing that a prison could possibly do is make money. And I'll give you an example of how that was built into the prison structure, even literally before a single stone was laid down. So the when it was decided that, so Auburn bid on hosting the new state prison. Basically, New York State wanted to build a second prison. New York State had one prison and it was overcrowded. The one prison was Newgate in New York City. And the state wanted to build another prison. And the state offered $20,000, which is about the equivalent of $500,000 today, in order to some location in order to host the new prison. And Auburn's businessmen decided to bid on this state contract. And the reason they bid on it was because they wanted the money. At the time, Auburn had only about 2,000 people. And you can imagine if you have a village with 2,000 people and you bring in suddenly $500,000 in state funding, that is going to completely transform the community. And it wasn't just 20,000 initially, it was also additional money to be coming into this village every single year forever. And so that's what they wanted. And they got the contract. And then once they had the contract, then they had to decide where to put the prison. And what they decided to do, these white businessmen, was put the prison on the banks of a river. Specifically, the Owasco Outlet was the name of the river. And they decided to put it on the banks of the river for the explicit purpose of powering factories that would be inside the prison. So it actually says it in the deed that part of the circumstance under which the land was acquired by the state agreed to build a dam over the river, which would then power these factories that were being imagined in this prison that didn't even exist yet. And half of the power from the dam would go to power the factories, and half of the power from the dam would go to power the businesses from the white businessmen who had these businesses in town. So this was using state funding to build a dam to benefit local businesses and to create factories, to enable factories inside this prison. So in a way, the prison factories were imagined before the prison was even built. So then the prison gets built on the banks of this river. Indeed, factories get built right into the prison. And then people like William Freeman are forced to labor 12 hours a day in these factories that were inside this prison. So William Freeman, as a 15-year-old, was being forced to make animal harnesses. He was filing iron for animal harness 12 hours a day. He was also forced to make dye. He was dyeing silk. And then he also was forced to make carpets. These are some of the things that William Freeman was forced to make. Other people in the Auburn State Prison were making furniture. They were making combs. They were making guns. And they were even making locomotives, train locomotives. They were building small things and large things, and all of them were doing it 12 hours a day for no pay.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Bernstein. Okay, question then, looking at prisons today in America, and clearly we want to avoid the perils of presentism, but considering the historical context of Freeman's story, what impact or efficacy does that story, or could that story have on the narrative today about prisons in the United States of America, if
Well,
anything?
oh, it has huge impact today. So first of all, incarcerated people in the United States, most of them have jobs. It's about 80% of incarcerated people today have jobs. And some of those jobs are in things like manufacturing or staffing call centers. Or fighting fires. A lot of their jobs have to do with maintaining prisons themselves. So they do laundry, they do washing, they wash floors, they cook. All of these things that are designed to make prisons that are designed to offset prison costs, which is to say, to generate value, to generate economic value. People are paid in many states in the United States. Incarcerated workers earn nothing. They also have no choice about whether to work or not. And this is a direct hearkening to William Freeman's experience. William Freeman received no pay, and he also had no choice about whether to work or not. So for many people in the United States, their experience of incarceration is in those ways quite similar to William Freeman's. Some people in the United States who are incarcerated do earn money, but they earn very small amounts of money, and they also do not, in general, have the rights that other people have with regard to their wages. So, for example, in many places, incarcerated people do not have the ability to save money and accrue interest. If you or I wanted to put money in the bank, we could put money in the bank and we could accrue interest. We can make that choice. Incarcerated people very often cannot, and often again cannot choose whether to work or not. So these are completely living reverberations from the story that I'm telling. Another really important reverberation is in the fact that the Auburn State Prison, where William Freeman was incarcerated, still exists. It is now called the Auburn Correctional Facility. It houses 1,300 incarcerated men, and it is today the United States's oldest continually operating maximum security prison. And it is still, to this day, a center for manufacturing. Today, what is manufactured in the Auburn Correctional Facility is license plates. All New York State license plates, every single one of them, is made by an incarcerated worker at the Auburn Correctional Facility. So if you have ever seen or been near a New York State license plate, and I know that some of your listeners are that's very likely, and for some of your listeners, that's very unlikely. But any of your listeners who have, that New York State license plate was individually made by an incarcerated worker in the Auburn Correctional Facility who was literally walking in William Freeman's footsteps.
Wow. Well, I have like a display in my house, in my garage, of different license plates from when I did Route 66 and when I go to the States every few years. And I have a New York State license plate, so now I know exactly where that came from. And when you're talking about sort of the economic basis of the prison system, it's often something we associate with Stalin's gulag in the 1930s, political prisoners being put to work digging canals with their bare hands. I would not have associated it with the American or British or any other penal system for that matter, but well, you've certainly put that right. Okay, the final question for you then, Professor, is we've got lots of young historians that will want to follow in your footsteps, maybe not studying the same substantive matter, but what advice could you give young or maybe not so young historians, people that want to get into history, want to write books, want to research topics? Is there any advice that you could give them to help reach the dizzying heights that you have reached in your career? So if you were giving a bit of advice to budding young historians, or perhaps not so young, what would you say?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Thank you so much for asking me that. I would say the number one thing is to read, of course, to read history, to be curious about history. And I would say also the best thing you can do is look for things that surprise you. So when you learn about the past, notice things that surprise you. Notice things that make you say, huh, I wouldn't have expected that. And every time you say, huh, I wouldn't have expected that, that's the place to dive in. That's the place to learn more. There's a saying that the past is a foreign country, and it's a good thing to be curious about the past and to notice the ways in which the past is different from our own experience. Notice the ways that the past violates some of our expectations. So I would say read a lot. Think a lot about the past, and every time you notice something that seems surprising, That's the place to dive in. That's actually how I found the story that I ended up writing about in Freeman's Challenge, the murder that shook America's original prison for profit. The whole book came out of me discovering that prison for profit existed in the North prior to the Civil War. And I thought that's surprising. I had associated profit-driven prison, and in particular convict leasing, I had associated it with the South after the Civil War, and a lot of people have that association. And when I learned that actually it was in the North be long before the Civil War, I thought, wow, that surprises me. And if it surprises me, it'll probably surprise a lot of other people too. So I wanted to write Freeman's Challenge in such a way that not only would it reveal the truth, but it would reveal the truth in a really vivid way, in a way that would be very compelling to read, a way that people would want to read it. I wrote it for your listeners. I wrote it for everybody. I didn't write it for an academic audience. I wanted anybody to be able to pick up Freeman's Challenge and learn about William Freeman's life and learn about the origins of prison for profit in the United States and be surprised.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Professor Bernstein. Before we let you go about your day and continue down the rabbit hole of academia, could you remind us of the title of your wonderful book, just so our listeners, if they got to the end of this podcast, can go out and hopefully buy it from Amazon or preferably from a good old-fashioned bookshop?
Thank you. The title is Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. And it is indeed on Amazon, and it is available through your local bookseller.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.